everybody. My name is Emily Denny. I lead external affairs at AstraZeneca, which is a pharmaceutical company right here in our region. We have about 2,000 employees that are down the street, so to speak, in our Wilmington, Delaware headquarters, and another 5,000 spread across the United States. We make medicines to treat a number of disease areas. You might have heard of some of our medicines, but we treat cardiovascular disease, mental illness, RSV, and asthma, just to name a few. And I get to lead the team at AstraZeneca that is responsible for engaging with our nonprofit partners. And we really enjoy partnering with patient groups and community groups because they're the groups that are on the ground, really helping patients beyond the medicines that we make or serving our communities in which we get to work and live, and that's really important to us. I'm really excited to be here today on the panel to talk a little bit about how AstraZeneca has really embraced a spirit of volunteerism. Some of our most engaged and most effective employees are those who volunteer and oftentimes volunteer through some of our employee-initiated programs. And for those employees, they've really been able to find a nice mix between passion that they have for giving back and some of the work that we do at AstraZeneca. So one quick example, and I know we'll get into a lot of examples today, is a group that volunteers at AstraZeneca with the American Cancer Society. So AstraZeneca actually provided funding to the American Cancer Society to build a Hope Lodge, which is actually not far from here. It's called the AstraZeneca Hope Lodge. And it's a place where patients and their loved ones can come and stay when they're receiving cancer treatment, home away from home. And this is a place where hundreds of employees have been able to go and give their time and resource. And it's been a really wonderful opportunity for them to really engage with the patients that we serve every day at AstraZeneca. So I'm really looking forward to being here and talking a little bit about how we've been able to marry a business strategy with volunteerism, and really grateful to be a part of this esteemed panel today. So thanks.
Well, thank you so much. Again, I'm Tiffany Dufu. I have a little bit of a cold, so just bear with me. My life's work is advancing women and girls. That's pretty much why I'm on the planet. So my life is simple. I know what's on my tombstone, and I'm just kind of project managing my life backwards. Right now, I get to execute my life's work as Chief Leadership Officer at Lavo League, which is an online destination for Gen Y women who want to elevate their careers. But I've spent most of my career in the nonprofit sector and academia. I helped to start a girls' school for a middle school in Seattle, where I'm from. I used to run a women's leadership organization called the White House Project. So from the perspective of a nonprofit executive who is partnering with lots of companies on social responsibilities efforts, and now working at a company for whom social responsibility and community and doing good in the world is part of the fabric of what we do, I just have a perspective on initiatives that work, some that haven't worked, but I wanted to kind of share as we have this discussion, really for me, what's at the core of programs and projects like the one that you just mentioned that really do good in the world. And one of those aspects is that they involve some level of risk. I just find that some of the initiatives that are the most provocative in some way end up creating the most social impact. For example, at the White House Project, we partnered years ago with Mattel to produce President Barbie, and I can talk a little bit more about that initiative. It was a very provocative initiative. It was very controversial, but we reached millions and millions of girls. The second kind of key to success that I found is really being able to answer some core fundamental questions, the first being, what do we do? The second, is it making a difference? And the third, how do we know? Very simple, basic questions, but really get at the root of whether or not your initiative or project will really be able to achieve the impact that you want it to. And then the third piece is just authenticity. You know, really focusing on whatever side you're on, you really being the change that you wish to see in the world. And a real kind of adept example of that is, you know, I currently work for a company that's all about elevating women's careers. But we're a technology company, and as many of you know, we have a challenge with women in leadership in technology. And yet, at Lavo League, our technology team is run by a woman. most of the women who are designing, most of the people who are designing, and the majority of our developers who are actually coding are women. So in everything that you do, making sure that you're living the mission and that you're living the project and that in the initiative, I think is really important in terms of credibility. So I'm excited to be here and excited to just talk about this topic.
Hi, I'm Kristen Stewart. I'm the director of the Philadelphia Center for Arts and Technology. I'm thrilled to be here. I am a Penn woman for sure. I'm a graduate of Pitt, a graduate of Penn, and I grew up in central Pennsylvania, so I have all parts of the state covered. Ask me anything. But I'm one of those women, I love my job, and I always heard, like, you know, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life, and I was like, yeah, okay, you know, but it's really come true for me, and I'm so lucky. The Philadelphia Center for Arts and Technology, also known as PCAT, because it's a lot to say. We serve about 1,000 students every single day by engaging them in high-interest programs in science, technology, engineering, arts, and math to help them really understand what their interests are, understand what their career options are, and hone the academic and 21st century skills that they need to be successful people. And I'm thrilled to have so many of you in the room today because we need all of you to fill the gaps that the disinvestment in our public school system has left. And I see my students not just needing after-school programs. They need access to better health care. They need access to better mental health resources. Their parents need access, and they need access to financial literacy resources. And there's so much that we can all do to come together to really elevate the next generation of citizens, because without us coming together, it really does take a village. And I didn't really realize that in other jobs I've had, but it's not until being in the throes of direct service every single day, seeing parents, seeing kids, having 2 full-time staff members, managing 1,000 kids and 30 part-time staff members, that you say, wow, we need everybody on board if we can make any sort of change in what's happened in our society. And we all have to get on board because it is the next generation. It's going to affect us as we get older. And they're all our children. So I'm thrilled about being here today. I'm also on the board of the Spruce Foundation and Philadelphia Give and Get. And the work that I do on both those boards is really redefine what philanthropy and what giving means for the millennial generation. Really helping people understand that if you're giving $10 to giving $10,000, the point is having a focus on intentional giving, whether it's time, talent, or treasure. I'm excited to share some stories with you today around different skilled volunteers that we've been able to access, one-time volunteer programs to continued volunteer programs to corporate giving programs. I'm just so excited to have the opportunity to speak, so thank you for coming to our session.
So now you know why I told you you were going to really enjoy today. I mean, this is really sort of the dream team on this subject, I think, because we've got the perspectives not only about traditional volunteers or donors, but really the Gen Y and millennial perspective is really going to be powerful. So let's put a couple questions out and see how this provokes your thinking. Kristen, you talked a little bit about the differences in kinds of programs and having options. Explore that just a little bit for us.
Sure. So I think something that's important from both the nonprofit side and the corporate side is identifying what model of giving you're most interested in. So there's, of course, when you think about corporate giving, so much of what I see on commercials, it's like, we're going to paint this wall, right? It's like a picture of volunteers painting a wall. And that's really nice, but I only have so many walls to paint. So thinking about what kind of program is making the most impact. So one-time volunteer opportunities are really great when you're first establishing a relationship with a corporation, with a business, and an organization, because it really takes trust on both sides. You want to know that your employees' time is going to be used wisely, and the nonprofit organization really wants to know that this is a good fit and there's an authentic interest from the business end of the work that you're doing. So maybe starting off with a one-time volunteer opportunity and then expanding to more skilled volunteers. So thinking about how you can communicate with the organization best and how you can kind of help them to articulate their needs as specifically as possible so that you can match them with skilled volunteers from your organization. So right now I have a a skilled volunteer coming in helping me to create a fundraising plan, which again will create more of an impact than that one time and be more impactful for your employee as well. Additionally, thinking about continued mentorship type programs, especially when you're talking about youth and education, and then how that might develop into more of a financial commitment of your business is really important, because there is a continuum of opportunities to get involved, but there is a model that works for everybody, and it takes time to build that trust. So the important part is to get started, I guess.
Thank you. So Emily, you in your introduction talked about how AstraZeneca has really developed a model that has been able to marry the business objectives with some of the work that that your team is doing through the program that you have. Can you talk about what was the process like to sort of figure out where those intersections happened?
Absolutely. We've had a lot of different ways that we have volunteerism at work, but the two main ways are either team building events that have to do with a specific kind of team. So when I mentioned the Hope Lodge earlier, a lot of times our oncology teams who work in cancer, you know, are anxious to volunteer there. So that's a really nice match for us. It also helps that we are a supporter of the American Cancer Society. Just like Kristen said, you know, it's nice for a corporation to provide financial resources and then the all too valuable employee resources through volunteerism. The second really innovative way I think that we've been able to engage volunteers at AstraZeneca is through our employee network groups. So we have a number of different employee network groups, actually 13 at AstraZeneca. They were formed with the support of human resources, and they have three goals. They're supposed to provide help to one another and sort of networking and personal development. They're supposed to help the business be more culturally aware, both internally and externally. So these are employee network groups like a women's network, many of whom are here today. We have a working parents network. We have an African American network. So these are just a couple of examples. And the last thing that they're supposed to do is to give back to the community. And what has happened with these groups is because, again, they're trying to provide support for one another, they're trying to embrace cultural diversity at work, in the workplace. They've often adopted groups that sort of are in that same sort of passion and mission. So a good example is the African American Network adopted FAME, which is an organization in Delaware that's really committed to trying to foster opportunities for underserved students to pursue degrees in STEM, science, technology, and engineering and math. And STEM is a big focus for our company as a healthcare company. So it works really well. Again, an organization that's focused on doing good work that we too as a company want to continue to support, and then a group of volunteers who also have that passion. So that's been something that we've really found has been successful.
Good. Tiffany, you said that as part of your work at Lavo League, you know, young women are coming together for career advice and mentoring and really trying to shape their future path. How often does volunteerism and sort of social engagement around impact issues, how often does that come up in those discussions?
Well, it comes up all the time. So we try to be a full circle. Part of our strategy for engaging individual women in being committed to elevating their own careers is by demonstrating to them what it means for us to elevate all women. So for those of you who may not know, although I'm sure everyone in this room knows, we actually have a leadership crisis when it comes to women around the world, but unbelievably in this country. In terms of politics alone, we are ranked 73rd in the entire globe for women's political leadership. That means there are 71 countries that have more women in positions of power and leadership in politics than the leading democracy. And across any sector of our society, we lead at about 17 or 18%, although we're over half of the population now. So for us, that is an issue. It's a social issue, and it's a crisis because, you know, when I was growing up, my dad used to have all of these conspiracy theories about how there was this, like, elite group of people that ran the world, and I would be embarrassed when my friends would come over and he'd warn us about these people. And, of course, over time, I've come to realize that there is, in fact, a small group of people at the highest levels of corporations, of government, that make decisions that impact every single one of us. And until those rooms are diversified with more women, with more people of color, with more members of the LGBT community, we actually do have a problem on our hands, because for whatever issue you care about, whether it's healthcare, whether it's education, whether it's the economy, whether it's safety, there are people at the end of that that are really making decisions that impact all of us. So we use that rationale for diversity at the highest levels of leadership to inspire and motivate people to reach for the stars, to lean in. Full disclosure, I'm on the launch team for Lean In. full disclosure. We do so that it's really a full circle. So do you care about this issue? Well, then you need to invest in your leadership in order to make that issue, you know, eradicate that issue. And here are the resources that we have for you in order to help you to do that. So it's completely full circle.
So the best sort of illustrations are always, you know, the real life stories that either have gone well or gone off the rails. So I'll give you each an opportunity to choose whether you want to do off the rails or on track. And let's start with Kristen.
Sure. So I think one of the interesting perspectives that I bring is that I'm very new to this, right? I've only been really in a position of power for about a year and a half. I'm only 29. I don't have like these huge wealth of resources to draw from yet, and I'm slowly building that for my organization. I work with an organization, it's a business, it's called Indy Hall. They're a co-working space in Philadelphia, and they their space houses, it's for the independent worker, houses about 40 independent employees that run their own smaller companies. And so last year I engaged with them around Philly Give and Get, and through an auction we raised $6,000, which might not seem like a lot to some people, but could put give scholarships for 50 of my students to attend summer camp. These are kids that would have been home all day, every day with nothing to do. And so they were in 6-week programs focused on STEM and really left knowing what they want to do with their life. So that was kind of the first piece that we did. And after we raised that money, you know, they were so inspired by some of the stories that came out of that and really the pictures that the kids drew. If you can get kids to draw pictures of something, it's a huge sell. Remember that. So, you know, the things they did over summer, like one of the kids wrote he was excited about farming. Like, we didn't take them to a farm, but an adorable picture of a cow. So we then went and did a show and tell, and we brought some of the students' work from the summer and really let the staff there experience the activities the kids were doing. And, you know, they made a vapor gun. They did oobleck, which is like this weird change of matter gloop. I don't even know what to call it. Yeah. But, you know, they had so much fun doing that that they said, we really want to invest more in this organization. So then they started, we were able to post on their site skilled volunteer positions. So we have someone coming up who owns his own SEO consulting company, very successful, who's redoing our website. We have teaching artists that come in who are professional painters, who are professional graphic designers, teaching those really high skill things to my students. And we're taking them down to Indy Hall, my high schoolers, to show their projects, their graphic design logo projects, on December 5th, and their professionals are going to be giving my students professional feedback around their business plans and around their products, which is not something that we could do without that relationship.
I have so many examples. I spoke about one earlier, so I'll mention that, and maybe if I have time, I can mention a couple others. Probably the most meaningful to me corporate kind of social responsibility effort that I've been involved with came years ago when the White House project partnered with Mattel. The first year was 2000 to produce President Barbie. And this was really a provocative initiative for us. The White House project was born out of the Ms. Foundation for Women. The Ms. Foundation was founded by Gloria Steinem and a number of women who really wanted to figure out what to do with the proceeds of the magazine at that time. And Marie Wilson, who founded the White House Project, had really built that organization and spawned what we now commonly know as the women's funding movement. So really for the White House Project as an organization to say, we're going to partner with Mattel and we're going to partner with this brand that in a lot of ways represents the antithesis of the values of this movement was really hard. It was really challenging. But we knew for a fact that there were billions of naked Barbie dolls littered all over the floors of girls' bedrooms around the world. And even though we had maybe come and grown into our own consciousness as feminists about what that represents, we all admitted that we had Barbie dolls when we were little, and that if there was a way that we could intervene in a girl's play and in her consciousness so that she could, instead of just imagining being in a dream house with Ken, like imagining calling a joint session of Congress, we thought that would be really, really, really powerful. And so we got a lot of flack, actually, and a lot of slack for this partnership. For Mattel, it ended up being really great for the bottom line. It's one of the most popular dolls. It only comes out every fourth cycle because it only comes out during a presidential election year. And we have been able to, over the years, to really shift Mattel in the production of the dolls. So, for example, over the second doll came out in different nationalities and in different colors. So if you are a Latina little girl, you could see, you know, President Barbie and she looked like you, or if you were an Asian little girl. And my most proud accomplishment was that our biggest kind of issue with the doll was that, I don't know if any of you remember, but on the back of the box, it literally says that the doll cannot stand on her own two feet because she just kind of teeters. And so, and we always used to say, you know, that's really bad that she can't stand on her own two feet. And she's the president, you know, of the free world. And in 2012, they finally engineered her shoes so that President Barbie could stand on her own two feet, which we're really proud of. Really proud. But, you know, I say all that to say it was an initiative that got a lot of people engaged. So employees at Mattel got very engaged. It was a doll that, you know, that they could provide for their own. We talked about different issues that would be Barbie's platform. You know, what would girls want to see? And how could we use that in order to engage people in discussions? We had virtual rallies. But it was just a way to engage a lot of people in an initiative that really, really made some impact, especially when it comes to culture, which is the most insidious barrier when it comes to advancing women.
Thank you. I'm laughing at the fact that yesterday, which of course was Halloween, I got an email from someone, and I'm forgetting who it is at the moment, but they showed a photograph of their staff. Actually, I see Kim. It was your team, and President Barbie was one of the was one of the people. Emily, you know, give if you can talk about, you know, some, you know, maybe barriers.
Yeah. I mean, I do want to emphasize that I think this sort of marriage of the passion that you have with employees and sort of what you're trying to do as a business is really key. Another quick example I'll give, and then I'll give you some barriers, is we have a group of cyclists at AstraZeneca, so they're, you know, big into cycling, and they actually decided to support this really interesting organization called the Cadence Group, and they're all about trying to have mentors for young, again, sort of minority students or underserved students, but also to try to get them moving, to try to get them healthy, and so they kind of married this whole mentorship with getting ready to ride a big race, and then they culminate the whole thing in a race. So again, it's this passion that the employees have for, you know, not just what they like to do, like to cycle, but their passion for giving back to the community, and also something that really resonates for our company, which is to help children be well and to make good health decisions. But I will say that one of the most frustrating things for me, you know, a lot of requests come into my department to say, oh, we want to do a big volunteer event, you know, usually these one-day events. And, you know, they can be really great. But sometimes they take a lot of thinking and doing and calling and coordinating. And so I would say to any of the nonprofits that they should think about how you could have sort of like a volunteer day in a box. And, like, what would that look like? And how, as Kristen was saying earlier, you know, like, how can you be a little bit more specific about the things that your organization needs, and then we can try and match that as a corporation. Because we also have lots of examples of enduring volunteerism too, like coaching and mentoring, I think, has been something that a lot of employees have embraced. And I would say too, for organizations like my own, trying to be, you know, more forward thinking about what would those opportunities look like. How could we partner with our third party partners in the community to try to, you know, figure out what those are going to look like before the requests come in? Because oftentimes, if it's the last minute, sometimes it's not quite as good a fit, and then it's not as good of an opportunity for the employees, and then the nonprofit feels like, ugh, you know, like we had to run around, and then it wasn't really worth it. So I think there is a little bit of planning that needs to take place in order to be, for it to be successful.
And stewarding the relationships post-volunteer. I know we see a lot of situations where, you know, people will come for one day or an extended volunteer experience, and then the only time they are hearing from the organization is, you know, when there's another project or when it's the annual, you know, fund or whatever. I meant to do this at the beginning and failed to because I wanted to get to the panel so quickly. Show of hands, how many people here are representing a nonprofit organization? So I would have lost that bet because I thought it would be more than 50%. It looks like it's about a third, a little over a third. And others here are representing corporations or just, so corporations. Wow, okay, you were right, you were right. I didn't think it was going to be that big.
Good.
This is why I love hanging with the young people, because they are so much smarter than me. Okay, so that if you couldn't hear this young lady up in the front row, say your name for us.
Oh, Annette.
Annette just reminded me that everyone who's here may not be an employee of a nonprofit, or but so let's see a show of hands. How many people are volunteers or board members or interested in getting involved? Now,
there you go.
We were both right.
I'm just saying, keep asking the questions, you get the answer you want. What's that? There you go.
Nancy, can we just talk, can I give another example of just something that didn't go,
yes,
go right? Because I think one of the biggest challenges that we have when thinking about giving and volunteerism when it comes to nonprofits and corporations is that oftentimes, and I've experienced it on both sides, the nonprofit doesn't necessarily have the infrastructure or support to be able to manage the effort that is envisioned. And years ago, when I was helping to start a girls' school in Seattle, we had this really amazing strategy of getting corporations engaged by focusing on companies who would also have lots of women who were in math, science, and technology, which was the focus of the school, and getting them to be mentors for the girls. And it was just kind of, it was a perfect vision. It was set up really well. But one of the oversights was that the school had just started. There were only two classes of girls, so there were about 60 at the time, and we were in Seattle, so we had Amazon, we had Microsoft, we had Boeing, we had a lot of really big companies with a lot of women engineers, a lot of women scientists who would be interested in this. Well, guess what? It was a very popular program. They were very interested, and we ended up very quickly with the problem of not having nearly the number of girls to accommodate the number of people who wanted to mentor them. And we decided that it was okay for a girl to have more than one, but when you start getting up to 5, 6, 7, 10, you know, mentors for a girl, it starts getting really ridiculous. And so we really had to figure out, how are we going to manage all of these people who have interest and really engage them in a meaningful way? And we just weren't prepared for that. And sometimes I imagine that if we had had, you know, real thoughtful support from a consulting firm or, you know, someone who really thought,
yeah,
or from the company,
you know,
we could have anticipated. We could have anticipated that, exactly.
Well, I think, yeah, sometimes we forget, too, as a corporation that, you know, we have all of these resources available to us. And so we recently invited a nonprofit who was trying to launch their website and having all sorts of trouble. And we're like, well, we've launched, like, 85 websites. We have all these people who are great at social media and online marketing. And so we invited them in for a session. And that was just, that was like a couple hours of each person's day that day. They didn't even have to leave the office, and that was really valuable to the nonprofit.
And just to build off that, from the nonprofit perspective, being really honest with what the volunteers might encounter. So I worked with a health organization, a group, this summer, and they send volunteers to teach health to my summer campers, and that's really great, and I was excited to have them, and my students don't generally get health in school, you know, really high rate of obesity, et cetera. But for the first few days and continuing over the summer, you know, I have kids that are having serious emotional meltdowns every single day. Really struggle to communicate because they've never really been coached in 21st century skills. A variety of issues, and I felt very upset because I knew the volunteers left feeling frustrated because they weren't able to do what they came to do, and they had this very clear lesson plan, and they came up with this really intricate activity, and it did not go that way. And I feel like it was a failure on my part because I didn't prep them for what they were likely to encounter. I was just like, this is great, I'm so excited to have you, the kids are excited, and they were, but I have a variety of extremely high-needs students, just like you will see in any youth-serving organization. And so really being clear about that, but also helping them kind of disseminate that learning of, wow, there's some really big issues here that are bigger than a health lesson that we need to be attuned to as a sector. And so I think in the end it really did help, but make sure you're honest with your volunteers about what's likely to happen versus what will ideally happen.
Well, I think you raise a good thread of conversation here because, you know, sometimes, you know, we take for granted, whether it's we as a volunteer, we as an employer, we as a recipient agency, we take for granted some of the things that we use in our business, which is, you know, there's no substitute for direct communication, setting expectations and really being able to dialogue around whether those expectations are being met or not. And then really, I think the follow-up to that is, you know, don't overlook the voice of the customer, who really is the organization, in your case, the students. I mean, you can have well-intentioned volunteer initiatives that, you know, come in and end up doing, you know, I wouldn't say damage, but, you know, setting the agenda back as opposed to advancing the agenda forward. Give me your perspective on whether you see, and I'm looking at you, Emily, because you've got the big organization of workforce. What generation do you see most engaged or most inspired to engage around this issue?
You know, I think at AstraZeneca, and I think every organization is different, we have, it doesn't have as much to do with generation as it does to, like, these affinity groups. So we find that close-knit teams or the network groups that I mentioned earlier who have a passion for what they stand for are those groups that are giving back. And we have a really strong employee network and a strong group of volunteers. And we haven't mentioned it yet, but one of the great things I think that you could do to help foster that is to reward and recognize those volunteers. So we use the Jefferson Awards, which is a national workplace volunteer group that wants to foster workplace volunteerism. And so each year we have, you know, maybe 10 to 15 Jefferson Award winners that we highlight. We invite the CEO to a lunch with them. We've had speakers come in. We've even had the First Lady of Delaware who's come in to acknowledge what wonderful work they do. And then one awardee gets to go to Washington, D.C. and celebrate with other folks who are strong volunteers. But I think rewarding and incenting that is a really important part of making it successful. But for AstraZeneca, it's more about these sort of affinity groups versus the generations. But I think, Tiffany, you have a view on that too.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, Live Elite spends a huge chunk of our time engaging with companies who are either having retention issues when it comes to Gen Y or just very interested in how do we recruit, how do we attract Gen Y. And one of the things that has just been very clear, and one of the reasons why I actually appreciate Gen Y is that it's kind of the first generation to fully expect that their career will be aligned with the way they create impact in the world. But that should be one and the same thing. And part of the beauty of that is when you are a company who can align what you're trying to do in the world to achieve impact with what people do every day, then you can make that connection. And it's really important to make that connection with Gen Y, because otherwise they won't understand, like, I thought I was going to be, like, serving the needs of people globally, and here I am making copies. Like, this isn't what I was supposed to be doing, you know? I think I need to be the CEO in order to make, and sometimes we misinterpret that as a sense of entitlement, when in fact it's actually this really deep desire to want to create impact and want to change the world, and you told me that I could do anything and I could be anything. All I had to do was find my passion, and then you recruited me and you told me this is what this company was about, and now I'm here, like, taking staples out of the paper, and I just don't understand the connection. So I actually think it's a really promising opportunity for companies to fuel and to really leverage the ingenuity and harness the talent of Gen Y by using, you know, social responsibility efforts as a means to an end.
I mean, I guess not surprisingly, most of my interactions are with millennials, and so that's where the majority of our volunteer population comes from. But definitely the millennials that kind of border the Gen Y, so generally people who have been in their careers for a couple years, so like, you know, 30-ish, and they don't have kids yet, and they really have additional time to give, but they feel confident in their own work that they can really, really give that. 91% of millennials, when surveyed, said they would leave a corporation or a business to go work somewhere else if that other place had a better giving program, all else being equal. And I see this over and over and over with my friends, the ones that are in the private sector, saying, you know, I like my job, it's okay, but if I could do something meaningful like you do, I would really love where I work. And I think that being able to give your employees that opportunity, especially the millennials, will mean so much when it comes to retaining your employees and recruiting them in the long run.
So for the business owners or business leaders in the room that do not have the resources and infrastructure of an AstraZeneca, how would, and anyone can answer this, how would you recommend that an interested employee, so you've got a couple of people in the workforce who say, you know what, we really would like to go do X. What would you recommend for people to initiate or start up a workplace team for volunteering?
I mean, the easiest thing that I can think of is something Lockheed Martin does, and they give all of their employees X number of hours a year to volunteer with them. They can choose where they go. They get paid for that time. They can take, I think it's like 16, it's probably more than that. But, you know, they can do what they want, and they get paid to do it. But really asking them to report back on what they're doing so that you can start collecting data around the impact of whatever program you choose is really important.
Building the case. I mean, certainly if you're small, you know, you may not have, I mean, I work for a technology company, we're not that big. You know, allowing employees to spend like a great deal of time has different implications than it does a Lockheed Martin or a Google who has their 20%, which is really awesome. I think building the case is really important, and there are lots of great resources for that. One of my favorite organizations is CECP. It's the Committee for Encouraging Corporate Philanthropy, and they just came out with their latest research. It's called Giving in Numbers, but it really helps to shed a light on the relationship between corporate philanthropy, whether it's giving, whether it's workplace campaigns, whether it's volunteerism, and the bottom line, which to me is always a great selling point pitch when you're, you know, the Lone Ranger trying to create change within an organization. So I would start with resources, making the case, making a case that leadership can hear and can really understand, and then giving case studies and examples of how to make it work. It's CECP. It's called the Committee to Encourage Corporate Philanthropy. But if you just go to CECP, you'll find it easily. Yeah. It's founded by Paul Newman. It's Paul Newman's project. Yeah.
The only thing I would add is, again, I think that it's really important when you are making the case for it there to be an alignment to what the company's trying to accomplish. There's so many wonderful charities and nonprofit groups that you could volunteer with. So if you can somehow find a marriage between something that the employees are passionate about and something the company is doing, I think that has the most success.
And just to build off that, only 5% of financial giving in the country right now is coming from corporations, 5%. So 73% comes from individuals. I mean, of course, they made money through some corporation, but this is really an opportunity to invest your company in a bigger picture of having a say in what's happening in the social sector and being able to make an impact on various social issues. So think about the values that you have in as your company and where you want to make that strategic investment, and then help invest your employees in that.
So there's been a lot of really good suggestions here, and my wheels are really turning. I'm going to ask for one just quick thing. When we were sort of gathering before the panel, Kristen was talking about,
Hatchifier.
There you go. Yeah. Could you just share a little bit about that, because it's going to be brand new to Philadelphia. And
Has anyone heard of Hatchifier? So Hatchifier is going to be brand new to Philadelphia. They're launching November 13th, an impact hub. And they're an organization that focuses on making volunteer matches between corporations and nonprofits. And they take a lot of the work for the nonprofits back, and they're able to help. So they help the nonprofit articulate exactly what their needs are. So if mine is a fundraising plan, what are my goals? What infrastructure do I already have in place? Who is the dedicated employee that's going to be working with the with the business, and how much time do I have to get this done? They help you articulate everything, so it's very easy for a business to pick up this project and say, like, yes, this is something we can commit to. They post the projects online, very similar to Donors Choose, except you're not donating money for school supplies. You're donating time of your employees to complete a skilled volunteer project, and it's fantastic. We're really excited, and I know you've worked with them in New York, so you can probably speak better to the long-term function.
Yeah, they actually work. It's a wonderful middle woman. It was founded by a woman for everything that we're talking about. So I hope that they catch fire across the country so that more cities can benefit from what they have to offer.
It's very exciting. So I've taken the lion's share of the time to ask questions that were on my mind. Now I'd like to open the floor for questions that are on your mind.
So everyone can hear, I guess. My question
tell,
is really...
Tell us who you are, first of all, and where
oh,
you're from.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name's Kim Carter. I'm from Warrington, Pennsylvania, just north of Philadelphia. And my question is really for Emily, because you're in such a large corporate setting. Do you find, especially with your little groups that you have, does it work best when your employees are giving to a large national organization or to a local smaller organization, nonprofit-wise?
I think it usually works best with the local groups. So we have our headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware, and so a lot of our headquarter-oriented volunteer activities are for those local groups. But oftentimes they're the chapters of the big national groups, so like the American Diabetes Association or the American Heart Association, for example. And then we have these employees who are spread across the United States, and our sales force is actually some of our most dedicated volunteers as well, really committed to their own communities. And so when we have large national meetings, we try to give back to the city in which that meeting is taking place. So recently there's a big meeting in Chicago, and they packed backpacks for kids in Chicago as they were going back to school. So I find that local connection is sometimes easier than the national for us.
Thanks. Good, great question. Thank you. Kim?
Hi, I'm Kim Landry, Hollister Creative. I'm a small business owner, and I'm constantly getting requests to purchase tickets to galas to support nonprofits. And although I do go to some of these, I would really like to be able to pay for some of my employees to go to other ones. But they're not interested in going, because the galas seem to people in their 20s and 30s to be very stuffy, mostly old people like me. You have to get, you know, a black tie or a gown. And it's just not their scene at all. And I wonder, what are some alternatives that nonprofits could come up with that would be social and have the networking aspects of these galas, but would appeal more to people in their 20s and 30s?
So, there's so many different ways. At the White House Project, we essentially had two events on the same night. So we had every year what we called our Epic Awards. It was that gala. I wouldn't say it was quite as stuffy. We got lots of celebrities to come, and we served like real farm-raised chicken and not like the rubber kind. And then immediately after the gala, so we would have dessert last, there would be this dessert reception, and while the people were filing out of the more stuffy gala and enjoying dessert, we would prepare the room for what we call the after party. And we would have the millennials who were younger, weren't able to quite get out of the office, you know, at the same time, because they're the analysts who were like there much later than their bosses. You know, they're showing up at, you know, and we're in New York City, so 8:30, 9 o'clock, 9:30. It's not too late to kind of start, get the party rolling. We bring in the DJ. We didn't have to pay any more because we had the event space already there. We already had the security, so it was easy for us to do. We sold the tickets at a much lower price in order to accommodate the fact that these were younger professionals, and we had twice the number of people always at the after party than we would at the gala because it was such a great party. And the fun part was they got to see all of the celebrities that were there for the gala. They got to see them as they went out, going along the red carpet. I mean, it was perfect. So that's just one example of a way to manage that intergenerational difference, which I know is really palpable. But there are some nonprofits who are just doing it completely different. I mean, Charity Water is a very good example of a nonprofit who does not do a traditional gala or dinner. They have really their, that at the after party I described is the Charity Water event. So I think part of it is finding the nonprofits that really do speak to that and want to curate that kind of experience and sending them to those.
And a great resource for that in Philadelphia is the Spruce Foundation. We have about 500 people at our gala. We raise $40,000 to give out to 4 youth serving organizations, and it is essentially the after party is the entire gala because no one wants a sit-down dinner. No one wants to do that anymore.
Yeah. And in the meantime, if you have to go to the gala, you can let them bring a date. That always helps.
Yeah, that helps a lot.
Sue. Hi, Sue Schick with United Healthcare. We just wrapped up our annual employee giving campaign, and it was really successful. I'm really proud of our team. Over 75% of our employees participated. But I could see a shift. I could see that our team members' expectations of employee giving and annual giving is changing. And so I'd be interested to hear from you. What strategies do you see employers using to really encourage their team members to be involved in annual giving programs? Or maybe they're dead, who knows?
I don't think they're dead. we're in the midst of ours right now, too, so I know exactly what you're going through. And we have noticed, we noticed, I think, a dip in the past maybe 5 years, but I don't think it's continuing. I think it's maybe reached a level for us that's sort of where it feels right for our employee base. I think we've just tried to make it as personal as possible. Like, you know, you can give to whomever you want, and the company makes it easy for you to do. And we've tried to highlight, again, our volunteers, sort of recognize them. They're all on our plasma screens this week, you know, talking about their favorite charities and why they give to them and why they volunteer with them, too. So we've tried to make it a bit more personal, and especially the giving part. So whereas before we were talking about volunteerism and having sort of your company sponsor activities, and it's nice to have a marriage, when we talk about the giving campaign, it's like whoever you want to give to, if it's your alma mater, if it's your a favorite charity that has nothing to do with work, you know, have at it. It's all about just giving back.
Yeah, and try to get some personalized things from the organization. Like we always send our video, which is adorable. We always send, you know, letters from the kids about what they get out of the program. And we create sort of an online platform that you can share with your employees so that they feel really connected to it. And you can also put volunteer opportunities on there as well. So if they choose to, they can take. And I know I feel that way about millennials especially. They really want to know what they're giving to and, like, really understand what's happening in that organization that they're helping to finance. So that's another way to get people more involved.
Yeah, I think it's also important to know, and I have a copy of this report, that the workplace giving campaigns, just amongst the span of all of employee giving, because, you know, some companies have matching programs, that those workplace giving campaigns are still the most popular in terms of participation by a huge round. So workplace giving campaigns, you know, people get participation rates even up to 43-45%, which is very high. Just the year-round employee matching programs are usually about 8%. They were last year. So it's still the most popular way for people to contribute. And I know that one way that companies are thinking about structuring those is around impact. So having some kind of time box campaign where everyone's contribution goes to something that everyone can see the difference that it makes. So selecting the cause or choosing the cause or choosing a theme in such a way that you can really show the impact and really show the numbers.
And if you can, ask the organization to explain exactly, like, what it costs. Like, it cost me $600 to have a kid full-time in summer camp all summer. Can you donate $600? It cost me $50 for the supplies for this child all summer and a healthy snack.
Okay, one more question, and then we're going to wrap up.
Hi, I'm Molly Rupert Sullivan. I'm with Accenture from here in Philly. Is there anything that's like the opposite of Catch a Fire where I could say these are the things I can offer? Who wants them?
I can give you my business card after.
I'll take it.
Yeah, I mean, link up with an organization that you feel passionate about and you feel like really reflects your values, and that would be, I mean, my best suggestion, because we need so much, especially local organizations. We are on shoestring budgets, and our employees are so overworked that having people come in and reaching out to us, it's like that will make my month if someone sent me an email and said, how can we help? It really would.
Catch a Fire does have an individual component, though, so you can just have something to offer. I have consulting skills, or I'm great with numbers, and they will help to match you with a nonprofit. Mm-hmm.
So let's show our appreciation to this really terrific panel.